WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen on time and in budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500. Views expressed on WEFT are those of these speakers and not necessarily those of Prairie Air Incorporated or the other station volunteers. We will be bringing you a rebroadcast of the Prairie Monk with Dave Monk in a few minutes. Thank you for tuning in.
Blowing chilly, and the frost is soon to come. There's apples in the basket, and there's leaves on the lawn. The air is bright with color, and the birds are soon to flight. There's nothing quite as tender as an October.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Stay tuned shortly for a rebroadcast of the Prairie Monk with your host, Dave Monk. My name is Bill Saylor. You just heard their October Nights title track from the Stone Soup album. And that was indeed Carrie Newcomer. Thanks for tuning in. We have a rebroadcast of the Prairie Monk program coming up from October 29th, 2000. In last week's program, I mentioned that I'd be looking for a follow-up program on grain elevators, which I did, but then I decided that there's a lot of technical detail involved and maybe running the two shows back-to-back isn't quite what I wanted to do. So maybe a little bit down the road, we'll have a follow-up to some of the things Dave Monk was talking about last week with the local icon of the agricultural side of the prairie, the grain elevator. Ironically, the program I have coming up for you still involves Dave climbing something. Being a program from 22 years ago, the one I'm about to run October 29th, 2000, some event details will no longer apply, but in selecting and editing archived Prairie Monk radio programs, I am retaining some record of various features of our community landscape and also of Dave Monk's activities over the years. I do spend a lot of time editing out references to specific dates and times, especially to say this week 20 years ago, because we do read a lot of announcements. So there's a balance between keeping the flavor of what was going on just then and trying to not confuse you about what's going on. That said, some things discussed in the program I'm about to air are still around and still happen in some form. So those that I've kept in this rebroadcast, I will comment on afterward. Granted, that didn't work so well last time, so I have some corrections to my comments that aired last week about Mumford House, which did not move from where it was, by the way. So I will also get to that after this program. Right now, I'll mention, though, that in this recording from October 2000, Dave refers to a race that had just happened that week, and that was one of the early years of the Rattlesnake Master 5K, 10K run and walk, which was conceived as a benefit to support prairie preservation activities. At the time, that meant Dave Monk's Heartland Pathways, and Dave and friends spent a lot of time when they started that event preparing a large number of photos and prints to give out as race awards to runners in the various categories in the 5K, 10K run, matting them, framing maybe the top ones and whatnot. Well, the annual Rattlesnake Master run itself continues to this day in 2022. And in fact, this year it is coming up next weekend on November 6th, Sunday. It is hosted now by Grand Prairie Friends. It has a course through Meadowbrook Park in Urbana, so runners can experience a prairie restoration. Rattlesnake Master, by the way, is a prairie plant. It's kind of tall and stocky with a distinguished seed head, so it made for a good logo graphic, or as Dave might say, a graven image. So if you want to participate in or just watch a late season run event locally, you can find more information about this year's Rattlesnake Master 5K 10K run through Meadowbrook Park next Sunday morning, November 6th, by visiting the Grand Prairie Friends website at grandprairiefriends.org. So again, thanks for tuning in. The following Prairie Monk program originally aired on October 29th, 2000.
Doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And I am Bill Saylor, and this is our weekly look at environmental news, natural history, cultural history, that kind of thing. And it's Halloween season.
Yes. Go out to White Heath. White Heath is kind of a wonderful place to be at this time of the year. They've got about 400 pumpkins, I think, carved. They probably have 1,500 cars there. Don't expect to go and get out quickly. You cruise past all these pumpkins. The Railroad Museum has a line that comes up from Monticello. And the Railroad Museum was pretty innovative. They had bought part of the old interurban and had put a mile and a half of railroad trackage on it when the Illinois Central just closed out. And the trackage they had was fairly lightweight. They put it in with their own energy. You have to know it's a lot of work to put in a mile of railroad professionally is like 2/3 of a million per mile. So they have a line up from Nelson's Crossing, which is where their depot is, which is down near the first exit to Monticello. And then they run up the hill, up the moraine, onto the Cerro Gordo Moraine. Rather nice to be running uphill. In fact, some of the steam engines they've had from time to time that have had leaky fireboxes, as they go up the hill, have dropped a little fire as they went, and they would follow it with a water cart. But the water cart is got a motor engine in it, and it's not awfully strong, and so you really had to take a run to get up the hill. So if you were following too close upon the train that was dropping little pieces of fire, you had to back off and come back up again. So it's quite a little hill. And that hill looks out over Lodge Park and in the distance, the Sangamon. And it's very, very good. They've done a lot of work with that. And so you should go, if you can, to White Heath and to the Railroad Museum and see what they're doing. It's all announced in the papers. They're pretty good at advertising these things. But Mr. Mofield at White Heath is on what is called the Y. At both ends of the Railroad Museum, they bought 7 miles. There is a Y. A Y is a technical thing where you can take a train a mile long and turn it. And so you go back with the engine going the other way. Now, it's not awfully efficient to do that, and some of the bends, one of at White Heath is probably the tightest bend, the tightest curve in Illinois, and it screeches cars as they go around. We've had cars come up to, we start there to go west to Clinton, and we start to go to Seymour from there. But at the Y at White Heath has you can turn a fairly large train on it. And that's about where Mr. Mofield is where the Y is. And so he has pumpkins set up in trees, ghouly things, owls. It's interesting in the daytime. It's interesting in overnight. It's probably more interesting the first day when the votive candles are a little brighter. But it's still interesting, even when the pumpkins start to break down some, it's still interesting. It's got character. It matures. So enjoy going to White Heath and joining that little community.
As much as a fan of Halloween I've been, it used to be, you know, my favorite holiday and whatever, I've begun to think, and maybe this isn't much fun, but, you know, it kind of detracts from the beauty of the season. In the end, if we're thinking about, you know, death and decay, and perhaps this is the season it's put there for that reason, because it's naturally the season of decay, but, you know, it's much more than that. It's part of the cycle.
Yes. The leaves have mostly fallen now, but they've still got their beauty.
I'm thinking here's something celebrating the time getting dark and being depressing. Well, I don't understand that. I want to go for a walk in the woods and while there are exciting. Still leaves on the trees and enjoy it.
I stood at Lincoln Avenue the other day on the overpass, which is, these are the mountains of East Central Illinois. You always stop on the overpass.
That's right.
Traffic. And you can see a swath of trees that are the top end of the Salt Fork, going down through the country club to a Banner. And you can actually, this time of the year, you can see all the trees in their differential state. The reflectivity of the leaves in the first place, if they were all green, the reflectivity is different. But since they all have colors, it's very, very interesting at this time of the year. Yeah. If you go to Peoria and look at the Peoria Heights as you come down the road that goes mm-hmm. across, it's very interesting to see fall. And if you go to Brown County, Indiana, where you've got a little height and a little rolling hills, and it's in the southern part of the state, it's renowned for this sort of thing. And at this time of the year, the roads are there also are jammed because of this activity.
There's plenty of trees in town, too, at least in the Champaign-Urbana community, which is a big town, and I'm reminded that when I drive in at night, which hasn't happened in a while, but you realize how sprawling the town is. At some point during my college education, I had a class, had a tour from probably the city forester, one of the city foresters or somebody, who pointed out that, you know, in town you live in a forest. He didn't necessarily point out that it's planted as a forest, that it wasn't necessarily that way throughout town in the first place. But yeah, if you're on the fifth or sixth floor of a building, if you can find one with five or six floors, you see a canopy in the spring, summer, or fall, and that's in it now. The canopy's falling awfully fast, though, on my
Chicago
block.
Has been honored to have some of the landscapers that we have talked about in the past, Olmsted and others, that have left a legacy of open space with trees in it, and so it is very interesting.
It's an urban forest, I suppose. Urban savanna.
This is changing the subject a little bit, but we had our race through the starts of fall and through Meadowbrook Park, and that was very nice. And as we worked our way through putting the awards together and working with Tom Rice, who's putting it onto a newsletter and putting it onto the web, we've been rather pleased. I have Ben over there at the moment in the next door building writing up the addresses so that we can send award letters to people. And there's a certain sort of efficiency about what we've been doing that we're rather proud of, because we're usually fairly laid back, and to get this stuff out and awards out and find the people who didn't pick up their awards and stuff is very good. And I've had a lot of help doing that, and to thank people like the people who came and played music, and it's all a part of the thing. And
it's almost instant gratification. It's like transplanting that bundle like blue stem. You can see that you did it. You don't have to wait for 10 years to see it.
It's institutionalized now. There will be a rattlesnake master run for the prairie in future years, and it will be in the fall, and it will enjoy this sort of atmosphere.
Of course.
Gallatin is tremendously beautiful at this time of the year.
Yeah.
We had an attempt to save the old radio antenna there. The old radio antennas, the WILL and aerials, were big-footed. They came down and sloped out. They were not pinpoint held by guy wires.
Where is this, in Allerton?
Allerton. They had one of these aerials, and I climbed up it with a movie camera at this time of the year. And it's interesting to see that all the bottomland forests, the bottomland maples,
remain green at the present time, whereas the upland trees are in their fall. And it defined the territory very well. Yeah. The time I got to the top, you see it goes up, the first platform gets to be a little less, and the next platform's a little less. So I had a rope that tied me on, and I kept going up. And by the time you get to the top, it starts to move.
Oh, yeah.
So it starts to sway. And I was wanting that kept. National parks often buy those sorts of towers so that you can see around. Some of the park districts in Chicago area have those. One in Vermilion County, I just got the list of awards that were made by the C2000 projects. Mm-hmm. And one was a request for a viewing tower. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get it, but it's a good idea. Mm. Well, the other element of this is that it is an attractive nuisance, and there's a liability of it. So the university actually bombed the forelegs and brought this thing down. And I was kind of sad and looking at this, and along came a gentleman, and he said, you know, he says, I put that thing up. He says, it was my honeymoon, and me and my wife put this thing together.
I'm not kidding.
And he was, he didn't shed a tear, but I could feel it was very close. He was sad to see that go.
He showed up when it came down?
Yes.
So there was like an event or something?
Just by happenstance.
Really?
I happened to be there by happenstance just because I was commiserating with myself that we'd lost what I thought was a very valuable viewing device. Yeah. And mainly because some people were afraid of the liability. And I was kind of testing the liability of climbing to the top of that thing. And then taking out a moving camera, which in those days was a little bit heavier than the current moving camera or video camera. And so they're nice memories of fall. That I'm Australian, and I grew up close to the equator. And when you get close to the equator, you don't have this change of seasons. It's much more mundane, the same. And there's seasonality, but one season moves into the next. And so if Christmas bells grow now around Christmas time, they also grow a little earlier and a little later. It's not as dramatic. Mm-hmm. And you don't have the, in spring when people come onto the quad and they've had cabin fever.
That's right.
There's this tension that's released that's and there's dogs and there's people and there's frisbees. Throwing frisbees and balls. Yeah. I have not experienced that in my lifetime until I came here and realized that there is this cloistering inside during winter. You can't do so many things.
In Chicago, the official start of summer has kind of ended up being Blues Fest this first week in June or something. I guess Memorial Day is immediately before that, but Memorial Day holiday weekend, so it's the same thing. Up there, of course, it takes a little longer for summer to come by.
The further north you get, the later it will be.
But
the shorter your season, you actually have to plant corn that is a shorter growing period corn. If you grow long growing period corn, it's not going to do very well. And you have to harvest it early. So you may be harvesting before downstate because downstate is using a long period plant. So all this sort of periodicity is interesting and intriguing.
And it's interesting to see the prairie this time of season, too, not just the trees.
Oh, my word, yes. I have to say something about the prairie. We have an exhibit in Levis. I don't know that it's seen by a lot of people because it's on the sidewall and you have to be going there to a meeting to.
Well, I have to explain what Levis is too.
Oh, Levis Faculty Center is a faculty center on Illinois Street, and they have art exhibits every once in a while. The bottom floor is a visitor center for students coming to see what the university is like, and they have a lot of guides that take people around the university. They have a lot of photographs of different sites around campus so that they can introduce to them. The other floors are used for speakers, especially the advanced studies speakers, the Miller Committee and things like that are there. So we have a small exhibit, and we're going to augment that. We're going to take in a lot of flat. We'll be the only ones there. We have to pay for the opening, so there won't be an entrance fee, but we're hoping that we get some people that make it worthwhile. And we've advertised it in the News Gazette and Octopus and hopefully the DI and a few others. And what we'll do is show some of these pictures that we have been working on over the years, and it will be a review of some of a pictorial review of some of the things we've done, and you can ask questions of us and why do we do this and why do we do that, and so that will be for 3 hours on Sunday afternoon. Then Eisen comes along, and they will have an event after that. Our event that it will be before that will also be a sale, so that we can sell to people. Many people asked about our awards at the run.
But mostly it's open house. You can just drop in, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So just that's in the
afternoon. A friendly event.
And you are listening to a rebroadcast of The Prairie Monk with Dave Monk that originally aired here on WEFT on October 29th, 2000. Back in the days with, yes, slightly noisier studio equipment. Thanks for listening. Now back to the program.
Well, I thought that I might say something about bees, and I called up David Eisenman and was wondering if he might come sometime too. David has bees in his backyard, and he's on Hessel and Hessel. And what's the street you're on there?
I'm on State.
State, Hessel State and Street. State, right in town, you see. And he sometimes distributes to his friends.
You mean there's bees by my house? Is that what you're saying? That I don't know about?
The bees will probably be visiting your house if you have flowers. And I have a fond feeling for bees. It's very difficult to run bees because they're so subject to herbicides and chemicals. They're subject to disease like fowl brood and stuff like that. But they're so essential. Many, 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 and most plants are dependent on bees for pollination, and you can still see them around right now. They're there. They're not the leather jackets that you get to have problems with sometimes that are desperately looking for sugary things. These are bees looking for pollen, and at this time of the year, they wind down. But I grew up with bees. I used to work for the next-door neighbor, who was a beekeeper, and he had about 700 hives and a couple of old international trucks, and I learned a lot about bees from him. He grew up climbing up trees to find swarmed bees. Bees are absolutely fantastic colonial organizations. No way is a human going to alter bees' behavior. These are not pet puppies or anything. These are creatures that have their own mind, and they're genetically bred that way. And if you want to work with bees, you have to find out how bees feel about things. So you soon find out if you are working with them. My friend Fred Bedridge would climb trees and get swarm bees because the queen is a specially selected individual, and you can see that on the combs. The combs have a little bump, and out of this sort of a larger cell than where they combine a couple of cells comes a queen, and the queen has sometimes a virgin flight and then sometimes a mating flight, and then it comes back loaded with semen, which will fertilize the eggs for a long time. I'm not quite sure how long they live, but the queen lives longer than the workers or the drones. The workers are intriguing. The queen lays an egg in the wax that is produced by glands on the bee. The bee receives pollen as food and grows very quickly. The first thing that they do is they eat lots of pollen and nectar. And the queen leaves a lot of pheromone-like materials, little drops of chemicals that create the bee. And the bee, if it's a worker, will first of all be interested in cleaning out the cells, because cells, once the bee has climbed out of them, are reusable. And that saves a whole lot of energy. In fact, modern beekeeping was made possible by a man who discovered how to facilitate this sort of thing. Let me perhaps say that in ages gone by, you will see, say, on the Masonic Lodge, the symbol of a Masonic Lodge is a beehive, and it's a sort of a round thing. And you almost had to destroy the hive in order to get the honey out of it, because this was a mass of cored hexagonal cells together, and with not a great deal of order. You couldn't extract a part of it without destroying a lot of it. So, or you had to chop off the edges or something like that. And then a guy, I think it was named Lombard, decided that it would be better to have these creatures in a box and have a box with several different layers, sort of frames, and allow the bees to work on those frames so that you could take a frame out and take the hot knife and remove the caps of the honey cells and spin them out. Now, he didn't invent that all at once, but what he did was he facilitated the gathering of honey. And that was only like 150 years ago, not too long ago. And so the standard beehive now has a box which is about 2 feet by 1 foot six, and you have a series of frames. It has a little slit cut in the bottom where the bees enter, and the queen is in the lower level, and then you put supers on top of this. Sometimes as many as four supers. So if I'm moving bees with my friend to lift a hive with four supers, especially if it is full with honey, is hard work. So going back to the worker, first of all, cleans out the cells, makes them if necessary, because they have the ability to process wax. Then they graduate to being in charge of things. Their hormones or whatever have cut in a different manner then, and they become the people in the hive that care for it and guard it. Slightly before that, they become workers that will help to control the temperature of the hive. They will flip their wings and act. They will encourage a breeze to go through the hive and keep it cool, or they will help to keep it warm in other places. So you have to have the beehive has to be, I think it's about 92 degrees. It's if it gets cold, the bees die. If it gets too hot, it's not so good either. So then the worker graduates to going outside and being a bee that collects, and that's what it does for most of the rest of its life. The drones are only useful for, as far as they can make out, I think, mainly for sexual purposes, and then they eventually die off. But the whole biochemistry of a beehive is absolutely fascinating, and the queen grows faster than the workers grows. There's a differential between how long it takes to come from a grub to egg, larva, pupa, adult. Now, when do you get new queens? Well, you get new queens when the hive starts to feel like the old queen is not laying very fertile eggs and the sperm has run out, and you can check the queen. The queen sort of roams around. It's a bigger insect than the regular bee. You can see them. And then you'll see that somehow the hive has decided it's time to increase, and you'll see big lumps, and there'll be several queens. So one of them hatches out first, and then it's a pretty mean queen. It will run around killing the other queen cells off. And that's pretty tough. So some of those cells will sometimes decide to go swarm. So they take with them half the hive sometimes, and create another hive somewhere else. Sometimes the people have found them in their house roof, under the front steps, or what have you. Bees are also pretty sensitive to what sort of weather it is. If you want to get stung by bees, then one of the first things to do would be to drive a car into a row of beehives or near them so that the fumes of the gasoline get in their nostrils, and that makes them furious. So you don't take a vehicle very near to hives. You don't go on a dull day. They like things warm. When you put hives together, you put them on the side of a hill facing the sun. And you do it with a little common sense. If you're in Australia, you have pretty much open space, so people aren't going to be affected by your bees. But if you have young children around and the like, you can put a fence around your beehives and encourage the bees to fly out and up, and then they don't run into George Willie, who's about to push the hive over or do things like that because he's been stung by a bee. You keep the bees out of the way of the people, and there won't be a problem. And also, you can always give a bottle of honey to people that enjoy. It's amazing. The neighbor that I used to work with, he had to shift his bees regularly, and that's what professional beekeepers do. You go in the middle of the night, you wait till at least 6 o'clock and the bees have come in, and you take a little slat and you tack it across the entrance hole, and then you pick up the hive and put it on your truck, and you might be going from heather on the coast, sort of the low native plants, to redwood. Redwood is a eucalypt, and it might be flowering. Bloodwood, for instance. Say we take bloodwood. So you take your truckload of bees to the bloodwood that's in flower, but the bloodwood won't be in flower for too long. So you might have to drive 150 miles to get a good crop of bloodwood where you have arrangements to do this. So in the middle of the night, you drive 500 hives, several trucks, and you put them down and carefully, and then you take off the little slits. In the morning, the bees are there available to get a different sort of nectar. And if you are near to a beekeeping family, you eat honey the same way as you eat preserves or jam. I mean, there's clover honey, which is totally different from alfalfa honey, which is totally different from eucalyptus honey. Ironbark is strong. So you become a connoisseur of honey. Bees should be fairly much on high ground, but you know, alfalfa fields and clover fields that are cut for hay, which are very dependent on bees, low. So the farmers like you to be there so that you'll pollinate their crop. But if it rains excessively, then you have to go out and do something with your bees. One of my most traumatic or exciting experiences was to have the Clarence River flood. And Fred had his bees on lowlands. So we had to row in a boat and pick the bees up off little knolls where they were still okay. And we would then row them to dairy bales. This is where you used to milk cows. It's a little different from here because Australians don't have to have indoor dairy barns. You have milking bales. And we put all these hives on the roof of the milking bales. And by the time we'd finished, the river was running really fast. And we could hardly row that boat back to the shore. And then we could realize that the relatives and friends had begun to worry about us because we had searchlights looking for us in the distance. But we did save the bees. But boy, it was a dull day and the bees didn't like being moved, and I had hundreds of stings. And stings are strange. The first 2 weeks you're working with Fred, like on a school vacation, you'd come home and first 2 weeks your hands would swell up like there's an allergenic response to this, and your eyes would swell if you got bee stings. But then after that, it would cool down, and you would get bee sting, and it wouldn't affect you so much. The bee dies when it stings you, and it has a little package of venom that's in a bag. And if you know your onions, you get your fingernail and you light it down your arm where you've been stung, and you pull that needle out without squeezing the bag, and you're in better shape, you see. So there's certain things you do. First of all, you wear a white uniform. You have a beekeeper's coveralls, and the white uniform usually has a very tight weave, for it's very hard for a bee to get into it. You put elastic bands or bicycle clips around your legs so that they don't crawl up your legs, and the same with your arm. And then you have a veil, a hat and a veil, also white. You can see through the veil, and you have a smoker, and you smoke yourself, and you smoke the hive. You open the top of the hive and you smoke into it. That quiets things down for a while you operate with it. The old timers don't do that. They just they wear a pair of shorts and a shirt and a pair of sandals. And I've seen my boss go head over heels. He would persist in wearing sandals, not boots. And if you're in a forest, or you have down sticks, and he would get a stick in under his sandal, and then he would be head over heels and with a hive of bees or supers. But that we would have lots of fun about that and torment him, but he would never need to put on a veil. He liked carrying veils because sometimes it does get to be a pain. But anyway, we would have to harvest the crop. Now, if you look at one of these frames as invented by the Lombard, the guy who made these boxes and supers, you take a box out and you'll see that some of it is brood cells and some of it is storage of honey for preparation for winter and over storage. So you take a knife and you cut the wax off the top, and you decapitate the cells, and you quickly pop it into a centrifuge. And then you have a traveling centrifuge and you spin the honey out of the and catch it. Then the wax is left. Most of the wax you send back to the hive because the insect is saved a lot of energy if it doesn't have to convert its wax into doing it again. So if you put in a new super or a replacement super, you buy wax, which has been pressed in the shape of what bees like, that octagon or hexagon that is the right shape and the right depth. And so you save a lot of energy that way. You can also understand that people breed bees. They find the ones that do the most collecting and the most circumstances and the least, they're more friendly perhaps, and so you breed from them. So some of the bees that are around are honeybees that have been encouraged to do their thing. Well, what do you do with the wax? The wax is worth about five times as much as the honey. So what wax you've decapitated off the top of these cells, you put into a big vat and you heat it up and you pour it into blocks, and you take off the hot honey which is left there, and you stir it till you get it impurities out. There might be some things like little pieces of dark honey or and pieces of frame or something like that, they'll fall to the bottom, and you do this. And you take your honey back home and you bottle it and sell it. And it really sells at a fairly high price because there's not that many bees and there's not that many beekeepers. It's hard to do this. If you do it as Dave Osmond does it in his backyard on Hessel Boulevard, then you have one or two hives and that's about it. But it's surprising how much honey can be stored in a hive that has three or four supers and is in a good situation where there's plenty of flowers and the bees don't have to work too hard. And there's also a whole lot bunch of theory, and I might get Dave in here. We might have a second session on bees because there's a whole lot of theory about how do bees communicate. What sort of colors are attractive? What makes a bee's life wonderful? What happens to its wings? What's like when it gets old? Its wings get broken down a little bit, and you can recognize an old queen, you can recognize an old worker, you can recognize an old hive, recognize a sick hive. You can just take your knuckles, knock on the side of it, and you can tell whether you've got a good and healthy hive full of honey or a light one, which has got might have foul brood in it or something like that. But it's kind of wonderful to think about this creature on which we are so dependent. Because most of our plants are pollinated by this creature. This creature settles on a flower. It doesn't give up till it's done with that crop. So if its scouts find a crop that's good, then they will harvest that crop and stick with it until it's done. Often it's crop like alfalfa. A good farmer will harvest a crop of alfalfa when it only has about 10% flowers, but some farmers don't harvest it at the right time, and bees have a ball because there's much more flowers on it. But somehow they go back to the hive and they communicate with their friends and relatives, and they fly back and work on that thing. Other insects that are around that do some pollinating are not so like that. They'll jump from one flower to another flower, and you might, if you've got a microscope and look at the pollen on some other arthropod, it may have lots and lots of different pollen, and it's harder to get a pure honey from that sort of situation. In fact, these insects that don't usually have a honey in their mind. The pollination is just by happenstance, and so is it for the bee. But if you're wanting to pollinate your crop, you better have a bee that's going to go back to the same crop that you're wanting to have it pick up pollen from here and transfer to there on the same crop. So it's very nice that a bee will be a specialist like that. So. Anyway, I look at bees. There are also solitary bees. When I went to Ames recently with the North American Prairie Conference, there were people working on prairie plants, echinacea especially, and what they were doing is using solitary bees as well as communal bees, and they put them both in the same cages in different settings, and they would help to pollinate the prairie plants. So I look at bees with a great deal of fondness. I'm cautious of some of the solitary bees. The bumblebees can really zap you if you get bitten by them. So don't annoy them. Don't hit at a bee. Never squash a bee. If once you squash a bee, there'll be 10 million other ones that know that you've squashed a bee. Just take your hand gently, put it over your ear or wherever the bee is, and gradually move it down the side of your face and sort of encourage it to disappear. I have another technique for leather jackets, which are not really bees, but if they're annoying me, I go and get a pop can.
Yellow jackets?
Yes, and I just invite it for some sugar. And so you
makes sense. That's what they're there
you
for.
You get used to doing little things like that if you're working with a bee, and I think you ought to take photographs of bees. Wonder how they're working a white flower or a yellow flower. just think of, that's what makes life outdoors rather wonderful. I think I was thinking about that the other night. They've got a series on television that has to do with birds, and they are looking at some of the behaviors of birds that are very interesting that we would never see if you're a human being in this world without the aid of photography, and I really applaud what they're doing there. It was on WILL, and it's a series. I think there's 10 films. They look at how birds eat, how birds communicate, how birds fly. I've been watching it very late at night, but it's really worthwhile, some of these things. It would cost us a fortune to go to the Galapagos and find these creatures. And so I'm very complimentary of people like Jessica So and others that do this as a specialty and bring us this information and bring it to us in terms of microscopes and charts and graphs sometimes, adding to the story with dignity, so that you
with get data.
Yes, data, yeah. And Nova does this very well.
I just picked up a book that the Natural History Survey has published, and it's kind of an abbreviated field guide to Illinois birds. But it's not just a field guide that you can take out with you and say, oh, is this bird such and such? It actually has some of the data with it. And it kind of focused on the Mississippi River and the Illinois River as flyways.
There's one coming up on insects that is really, I think, will be very good.
A publication?
Yes.
There is also one on the same shelf, How to Identify Slugs.
Yes, and there's
it was
one
on slugs. It was very thin.
Snakes.
It was a very thin tome.
So we have to be very, very laudatory of these people, and some of us will be going off to the Illinois Nature Preserves Commission meetings. This group looks at Illinois natural areas and adjudicates on their preservation, their dedication of them, and it's a quasi-state group, about 7 people that are on a board, and they're from both parties, and they're appointed by the governor, and they do their stint, might be 3 years, on this board, and they are approached by the staff, which has these things to report, and they adjudicate on it. They don't regard themselves as experts until they're made experts by the staff member that is his or her responsibility is to inform these people as to what is going on here. And I rather enjoy the staff and the way it does this, and then they report on regular things like the Illinois Beach State Park, where there is an asbestos problem. And so I just go to those on principle. I think they're wonderful.
And the commissioners I've met are very approachable.
Yes.
And the staff.
Yes, absolutely. And this is so for so many different organizations. You might think government being big is a pain sometimes, but some of these people are walking dictionaries of everything. They have their specialties, but wow. You go into their office and ask a question, and they go to the herbarium and pull up a plant and say, I just had to deal with an echinacea out there by Monticello. Ken Robinson had found that this plant was listed several times in the past as perhaps being slightly different, a different subspecies. And we gave it out as an award at the race. One woman who had made a lot of pledges for us, so we had an award for the best pledge getter, and she got the one which had this echinacea, but it was red, almost red purple, whereas the usual echinacea is a sort of wimpy light pink. So okay,
I have some announcements. Champaign County Audubon Society is having a field trip next Saturday. They'll be looking for cranes in the Jasper Pulaski Refuge in north central Indiana, so it'll be a full day. They'll be leaving at Anita Purvis Nature Center parking lot in Urbana, north of Crystal Lake Park, next Saturday's Audubon Society field trip to Indiana to see
very good
cranes.
Audubon does a lot of good work with birds and documenting them, and it's one of the main groups of amateurs that document in a scientific manner where the data is good for scientists.
And finally, if you are at the University of Illinois, the deadline for contributing to the charitable funds through payroll deduction is coming up. There are a number of organizations which are umbrella organizations, one of which is the Public Interest Fund of Illinois, which WEFT is a recipient of funds from. There's also the Environmental Fund of Illinois. And a lot of local organizations throughout Illinois are members of this umbrella organization. And I just wanted to point that out to everybody if they're looking for something to contribute to.
So this has been Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
I'm Bill Saylor. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next Sunday. Stay tuned next for Sruti, Music of India. This is WEFT 90.1 FM.
You've just been listening to a rebroadcast of the Prairie Monk program with Dave Monk that originally aired here on WEFT on October 29th, 2000, here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. My name is Bill Saylor, and I am back with you in the present day, which is October 30th, 2022, if you're listening live. You may be wondering about all those announcements from 22 years ago. Well, a surprising number of them are annual events that are still going on. The Audubon annual Sandhill Crane Birding Field Trip happens next week this year, Saturday, November 5th. They leave from Anita Purvis Nature Center. The main attraction is the evening roost of the Sandhill Cranes at the preservation site in Indiana. For more information, you can see on the web, champaigncountyaudubon.org, or email mail@champaigncountyaudubon.org, or search on their Facebook site. The Illinois Natural History Survey still has plenty of interesting books, or I think they do. They've been kind of running down their stock. There are certainly an assortment of newer guidebooks and references since we broadcast this Prairie Monk episode in 2000. A couple of the ones that have been published since then span at length the findings of your state scientists over the past 100 or more years, giving a longitudinal perspective of the ecology of Illinois. Namely, two titles of the Natural History Survey are Illinois Birds, A Century of Change, which discusses three comprehensive bird counts throughout Illinois, each of them 50 years apart. Also, Canaries in the Catbird Seat, The Past, Present, and Future of Biological Resources in a Changing Environment. These and other books, other abbreviated field guides, like I mentioned in the show, from 2000, these days are listed at clearance prices on the Natural History Survey website, but the survey websites are not well supported. And if you're interested, you would do well to phone the publication's sales office to find out whether a given print title is still available, or for that matter, whether you can go into whatever the sales office is these days and actually have a look at physical books. They also have posters and other products. Again, we're talking about the Illinois Natural History Survey. You can phone 217-244-2414 for more information if you are interested. So last week, incidentally, I added some comments after our rebroadcast program about Mumford House, which had come up in that discussion. Mumford House on the University of Illinois. This is a farmhouse, kind of an old frame farmhouse, which at the time was being looked at to being removed, basically. Contrary to what I had to say about it last week, it is still on its site, and that site is just north of Temple Buell Hall. This is on the South Quad of the University of Illinois. In my comments last week, I had actually gotten it mixed up with the Taft House, especially in that the Taft House is at a location other than where it originally was, and it is still being used. It's fixed up. It's used by staff. I am pretty sure that on the Prairie Monk, Dave has talked about the Taft House history at some point in detail. And so I'm going to be on the lookout to see if I can run across that recording somewhere. But the Mumford House is still on the South Quad, surrounded by modern buildings and this awful second bell tower they got there. But I got to thinking about that, and so I went down there after the show, and it is there, but it doesn't seem to be used, given that there's no front porch steps, there's no back porch steps either. It looks pretty vacant, and there's some holes in the wall, and it does not look like it's in very good shape. Hopefully that historic building, that could have a story to tell. Hopefully it's not being subject to demolition by neglect. In searching the university website for some information on that, there are stories about, oh, it'll take $1.5 million to restore it. I don't know who needs $1.5 million to restore a residential farmhouse. One would think it'd be the perfect opportunity for the right kind of interdisciplinary hands-on class. Anyway, Mumford House is still there. Speaking of the University of Illinois, it is indeed this time of year, if you are a University of Illinois employee, to designate or reallocate pre-tax contributions to not-for-profit organizations from your paycheck, each paycheck, in the charitable fund drive system. There are truly many organizations you can designate to, either individually or to an umbrella organization that spreads the money around to the various member organizations under the umbrella. The one we referred to in this program from 2000, one of them was Public Interest Fund of Illinois, which was affectionately known as PIFI at the time. That is now Community Shares of Illinois, and WEFT Radio is a member of Community Shares of Illinois, along with a lot of other great local organizations. Do note, however, that recently Community Shares of Illinois no longer reports the names of donors to the organizations it spreads the money to. So here at WEF, we will not know who you are if you designate donations to us through Community Shares. But it's still a good mechanism to fund a lot of good causes. The other organization mentioned there at the end of the program, I think, was Environmental Fund of Illinois. That's now known as Earth Shares Illinois, and it includes a lot of things like the Illinois Audubon and Overlands Project in Chicago, various things around the state. I donate to that myself. However, that umbrella organizations, even though it says Earth Shares Illinois, there are a lot of organizations in it, and many of them are the national level organizations. So I do kind of recognize that it's sort of watered down and not really completely local. But those things are still around. You can still support them. You can see the list of not-for-profit organizations at ccfd.illinois, spelled out, .edu for the charitable contribution fund drive at the University of Illinois. And again, the re-upping for next calendar year happens now. The window is through November 16th to redesignate or designate new, if you like. I would suggest, though, I've had experience that the vendor's website is kind of iffy. So don't wait till the last minute if you're going to go in and change something, just in case you need help to complete it. Other things we mentioned in the program from 2000. Harlem Pathways at the time had a little art show at Levis Center. That is not happening now. That truly is back in the past. However, once again, the Rattlesnake Master Run for the Prairie happens. This is the 24th year. Grand Prairie Friends is the beneficiary and the sponsor. Also supporting is Body and Soul Store in Savoy, where you can register for the run. You can see more details at grandprairiefriends.org. The run this year is Sunday, November 6th, 2022, starting at 9 a.m. at, I believe, at the Ray Street entrance. And the run goes through Meadowbrook Park. That's a 5K, 10K run and walk. The Rattlesnake Master Run for the Prairie to benefit prairie preservation. Started up by one of our friends that was associated with Body and Soul, and Dave Monk in Heartland Pathways 24 years ago. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Bill Saylor. This has been the Prairie Monk program for this week. with the voice of Dave Monk. And we will be back next week with another archive episode of the Prairie Monk program here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Stay tuned next for Sruti, Music of India.